Hello everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Rupali Mishra about her study of the creation of the East India Company and its relationship with the government of England in the early 17th century, entitled A Business of State, Commerce, Politics, and the Birth of the East India Company. Rupa, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
And it's lovely to have you. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an associate professor at Auburn University in Alabama, and I did my PhD at Princeton, and I've been working on this topic for a very long time now, so it's good to see the book finally appear.
It was definitely worth the wait, I have to say. Could you tell us what it was that led you to write this book in the first place?
This is a book that I've been working on since graduate school, and this project is actually not what I ever intended to work on. It was kind of an accidental end, I guess. Once upon a time, long ago in graduate school, I was doing a coursework essay that led me to the East Indies archives, the East India Company archives. And I, at that point, thought I wanted to work on something very different. I was actually going to grad school to work on early modern English Catholicism. And I had this footnote I needed to chase up for a paper, and started to delve into the East India Company archives. And I found that they were just so much richer than I could have imagined. And when you're an early modernist, you get very used to how piecemeal the archives can be, and how sometimes obscure or opaque, rather, some of the documents can be. To have a set of archives like the East India Company's is almost unheard of. The richness of the archives actually ended up leading me to change my topic entirely. And not only was it a very rich archive, but more importantly, I found that it actually spoke to a number of questions that I was becoming really interested in as I was going through my graduate education. And these questions of power and authority, and what the nature of the political state is in the early modern period. It turned out that these questions could actually be answered and asked really interestingly of the East India Company archives. So that's kind of how I ended up there. It wasn't really intended, but then once I was there, it was just too good to leave.
It's a really fascinating description of how you got to this book, because especially when you consider, as you mentioned in the book, that the East India Company, for all of its, the image of it, its stature in terms of the historical imagination, there's not a whole lot actually being written about it. That you have these great archives, these rich archives as you describe them, and yet so little has been done with them, especially for this period that you focused on in your book.
Yeah, it's one of the kind of really inexplicable facts about history, is that there are particular questions that people get really interested in and stay interested in for, however long they are. And while those are the interesting questions, other things may not get a lot of attention. So the East India Company had its, in some ways, its moment in the sun. Earlier, maybe 50, 60 years ago, there was a brief period of interest. And before that, in kind of the late Victorian and early 20th century, where there were a number of historians, kind of imperial historians, who were really interested in the East India Company. Since then, though, so for a lot of the 20th century, East India Company ended up being, if you weren't interested in the empire of the 18th and 19th centuries, the East India Company was kind of delegated to this area of, oh, it's just business stuff. It's not that interesting. And which was a shame, because, again, these archives are so rich that they actually have far more to say about all these other questions than just the kind of sheer economic history of this corporation or this venture. So So there isn't a lot of other historiography, or it's not nearly as rich for the early 17th century as it is for later periods, but that is changing. So I'm glad that my book has appeared now, and that's part of it. But what I've discovered over the last few years is that there's an increasing number of people who are also working on this. So I'm not the only one who heard the siren call of this particular archive. So luckily, it's getting now more the attention it's long deserved.
I can see why it's getting more attention now for another reason, too, which is what you describe is this fascinating intersection of history and historical disciplines. This is, in one level, it's history, it's a business history, it's history of corporations, which is very much in vogue right now, but it's also political history, governmental history, the history of business communities, and all that comes together in this very fascinating alchemy, in which you're seeing how you can't really categorize and put each discipline in sort of a separate box, that they all really blend together when you're telling the story.
Yeah, I was really struck by how easily these archives lent itself to these questions. And these are, as I said, these are the questions that really have fascinated me. And to not look at them just seemed a real pity, because this set of archives and the set of questions go together so well. So yeah, I was really interested in, like, as I was reading these, years ago to begin with, just amazed at how much this could tell me about how people thought about politics, about how people organize themselves, and these are questions of timeless interest. And like, this isn't just an early 17th century story in that sense. Like, these are the questions that historians have been grappling with for years, is that how do people organize themselves? How do they understand themselves in relationship to other institutions? How do they see themselves as having power? What are the limits of that power? Those questions I found really were being teased out and were being work through in within the body of the East India Company, and then within the company and its relationship to the wider state.
What you describe is an environment that is in some ways very different from the world in which we know today in terms of how business operates. I was wondering if you could start us off by taking us back to the late 16th century, early 17th century, and explain how it was that the East India Company was formed, and the degree to which it fit the type of companies that were being formed back then, and also some of the things that were very specific to the company and what it was that made it different from some of its counterparts.
Uh-huh. Well, so the East India Company is it's an incorporated body. It's a corporation. And we know lots about corporations today, right? We hear about them in the news all the time. Now, corporations were not that unusual in the early 17th century, late 16th and early 17th century. If you lived in London, for example, you would have come into contact with corporations as a regular part of your daily life. Pretty much all of the major kind of categories of jobs were organized in corporations, like guilds. A lot of towns themselves were incorporated. So they had, if you were a member of the town, if you were free of the town, you might have particular rights for living in Leicester or because you lived in London or something like that. So corporations themselves were not that uncommon. What was different, and what's really interesting about the trading corporations that we know, like the Virginia Company, the Muscovy Company, the East India Company, is that they were corporations that were founded with a few kind of particular rights that and privileges that they were supposed to make use of to run their trades. So they are these corporations were granted powers of self-government. They were granted some kind of exclusive privileges, and they were supposed to, and then they got those exclusive privileges, I should mention, for a particular, usually for a particular set of, like, span of years. And that those elements were some of what made them really distinctive from other types of businesses or shops or things like that. Like, they're kind of distinctive institutions. So they're really like a lot of other corporations, but they're also in many ways unlike a number of other corporations. So you might be familiar with, like I said, these guilds and the cities. But what's really unusual about the East India Company and makes it different even from some of the other trading companies is the scale at which it operated. So the East India Company was a very large company. So we don't know exact numbers of how many people were in it, but my estimate is that somewhere around 400 people. So it's very large. And it's rich. It was really, really rich compared to the other corporations that existed. So at that time. So the East India Company had hundreds of thousands of pounds at its disposal. And that is it's even a lot of money today, but in the early 17th century, that was ridiculously wealthy. That was money on the scale of the state rather than of most corporations or towns. So it was really unlike a lot of companies in that way, even as in some ways it was a very recognizable body. Now, the other main thing that really makes the East India Company different, again, from a number of other companies, is that joint stock character of it. So the fact that it was really centralized. The East Indies, which in the early 17th century meant everything from the Cape of Good Hope on. So it doesn't just mean India, it means everything on. The East Indies was really far away from England. And so to run that trade, it was very expensive to run ships out there. They were going to be gone for a long time. So to manage that risk and that expense, they organized the trade into what they called a joint stock. Well, eventually into a joint stock. It actually wasn't in the first few years, but by the 1610s, it was a joint stock, which meant that if you were an investor, you paid in your money and you had a stake in the company, but you didn't actually own any part of the ship. There was nothing on it. There wasn't like a chest with your name on it, that stuff was yours. It was just that whatever was bought and sold, when the profits were realized, you got a proportion of that. So that meant that someone had to make all those decisions for everything. And those someones in this case were the government of the East India Company. So every corporate institution has a government, but the East India Company's government, because of that centralization, because of the scale that they were working on, they had to manage an immense amount of resources. So there was a lot of responsibility and kind of wealth in their hands at any given time.
You used a word a few minutes ago that I want to return to, which is the idea of the grant, because we think of corporations nowadays as something you charter, you file, and you have this existence in the law. And what you describe in the book, and this is very central to so much of what you talk about in it, is the degree to which the grant of the charter for the East India Company is on the sufferance of the monarch. And that was something that I thought was very interesting, which was how this was not a procedure that was done in Parliament at the time. It was basically the choice of the initially Elizabeth the First, and then her successor, James the First, to make these decisions about the existence of the company that reflect the degree to which there is this interplay between the company as a business and the state as an operation and an enterprise.
Yeah, so we think of patents, and like you said, you just kind of file paperwork and you've got it. A patent or a charter, usually they use the word patent more commonly later on for whatever. There are a number of reasons, but later on they tend to use charter more. But they tend to call it the patent mostly. And that patent is actually something that it's not so easy to get. There's a lot of kind of political negotiation and you might say lobbying that goes in to getting a patent in the early modern period. So patents were they're kind of in some ways a new thing on the economic scene in the late 16th century. So up to that point, in the late 16th century, or by the late 16th century, the idea that the monarch would give an individual or a group of individuals some kind of special exclusive privilege in return for something was becoming more and more common, but it was also pretty new and it's still pretty rare. So it was that the patent as a grant, like this kind of economic grant, didn't exist in 1500. I can't say if you wanted to get one, you couldn't, because they just didn't have any way of thinking about that. The first ones were kind of mid-century, but by 1600, they were becoming much more common. And that was actually a problem. It was a political problem, even as it was an economic and political benefit for some people. Some people thought that patents were kind of abuses of power in the same way that, frankly, some people make that criticism now as well, that the idea that you would turn over, that anyone, the state would turn over a certain power or privilege to a group of people for a set number of years and restrict it from other people for a set amount of time, that was, for some people, it was really problematic. They saw it as an abuse of power. On the other hand, others, proponents of this, said two things. One, that it was the monarch's power to do this, that it wasn't an unjust use of monarchical power, and also that the Commonwealth really benefited, that the nation benefited from giving people an exclusive privilege, which is in many ways the same arguments for patents today, that you innovate something and therefore you get a time to make a profit off it before, and everyone benefits, and then later on everyone benefits even more because it gets cheaper. So that kind of logic was there in the late 17th century as well. So these late 16th century, early 17th century saw a flourishing of patent industries. So things like, I mean, there are all kinds of patents. They get made fun of in 17th century and 16th century texts as well, because some of them are essentially just cons. There's one in a Ben Jonson play, for example, where someone wants a patent to make wine out of raisins, and that's kind of used as an example of like something that you really couldn't do. But soap manufacture, importation of different goods, playing cards, there are a lot of different patents, and some of them get a lot of criticism. And there are also these patents for the training companies, and those are, if you think about it mentally, they're kind of, rather conceptually, the same thing, just writ large, where England had no trade to the East Indies, and someone needs to develop that trade, but it's going to take a lot of money to manage that trade and a lot of risk. And so to kind of entice people into doing that, you give them a patent. They will develop a trade, England benefits, and they get profits as well, in that because they're assuming also the risk. So that's kind of the logic behind a patent. Now, the patents, though, one of the kind of big arguments I make about them, though, is that you really have to see them, though, as this ongoing relationship with the crown, because it's such a personal relationship between whatever body has got that patent and the monarch. The monarch gives the patent, but they're turning over parts of their power for that to work. So the East India Company can do things because the monarch turns over power to the company to actually do those things. So, for example, to run the East Indies trade in the early 17th century requires a lot of bullion, silver and gold. Ideally, the East India Company, what people at that time say is, ideally the East India Company would have been able to send like English woolen cloths. That's England's biggest export in the early 17th century, is wool or woolen cloths, both of them. What they would have liked to do is take woolen cloths, sell those in the East Indies, use the profits from that to fund the trade, and then they've created a new market for English goods. They bring back East Indies commodities. It'd be great for everyone. Trouble is, you can't sell enough woolen goods in most of the East Indies to make that possible. So the way that they manage the trade is by exporting huge amounts of silver and lesser amounts of gold. It's primarily silver bullion. Now, that's not it's. You have to actually get special permission to do that. So one of the patents that the company gets is this provision to export a certain amount of silver each year to run this trade. Now, critics of the company say they're just bleeding England dry of money to get, you know, luxury goods. But their response tends to be that, well, yes, but they bring back stuff that makes even more money. So it's a net gain. So it's kind of a developing we can talk about this more a little bit later, but developing new economic arguments for how trade benefits the nation. Mm-hmm. But so the patent is this, that transfer of authority, or also even how do you govern yourselves abroad? Because you can't, if you're an English citizen, you're answerable to the monarch, you're answerable to the laws of England. But if you are in, let's say, Sumatra, how are you going to be governed? There are no justices of the peace anywhere nearby. How are you going to do it? The answer is that the monarch gives the company the power to use martial law abroad. And all of these provisions for how you actually manage the trade, these are powers that have to actually be granted by the monarch. And so the patent in that way represents this wedding together of these interests, of the company's interests, of the interests of these merchants, of the monarch, of the regime, together to make something that is supposed to benefit all of the parties involved.
It also makes it clear that, you know, for the monarch, this is pretty serious business. They are, in effect, delegating a degree of their sovereignty, and that's not something they're going to do lightly, especially, you know, given political theory at the time, given a lot of the debates that are ongoing, the ever-evolving question of the role of the monarch in England and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of where the company also then fits in. If we, you know, think a little bit about where it fits into the state, this is one of the reasons why the company is so tied to the monarch and the Privy Council, is that all of these powers that the company is relying on are powers that belong to the monarch. They don't belong to Parliament. So the monarch in the early 17th century was, by the late 17th century, this balance of powers changed. But in the early 17th century, the monarch is the repository for a lot of this kind of power to actually endow and enable people to act in the particular sorts of way that the company functions. If you want a patent, you don't go to Parliament. Parliament doesn't have the power to give you that kind of grant. That is solely in the prerogative of the monarch. So you have to depend on the monarch. And the other element of this is that the monarch on a day-to-day basis governs with the aid of the Privy Council. Parliament is, again, because that balance changes over time, Parliament tends to loom large in people's imaginations for, you know, what's the most important body in England. But in the early 17th century, Parliament doesn't happen all the time. It only happens occasionally. And it isn't necessarily supposed to manage the day-to-day government. In fact, it's not. It's the king and council manage the day-to-day government. And so the company is reliant and really tied to king and council, because that's the kind of authority that they rely on. That's the kind of authority that they need. That's the people who are willing to give them the power that they need to manage the trade as they envision it.
And of course, it's not even that clear cut, because you're talking about the king, the Privy Council, even Parliament, as though these are separate from the members of the company. And yet, as you described, there's occasionally overlap. The king is occasionally an investor. You have members of the Privy Council who are also very prominent in business. And so there's almost like a Venn diagram we're seeing here, with the East India Company squarely in the middle between this idea of government and this idea of business.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. The East India Company, so we talk about the company, it makes it seem like it's this kind of entity that belongs in and of itself. But the members in the company have their own ties to other institutions. There are people within the company who are incredibly powerful men in the regime. There's a kind of quotation from a letter from a company member in the 16-teens, where he talks about how half the Privy Council is a member of the East India Company. So the East India Company really encompasses not just the merchant elite of London, but a number of gentry, a number of aristocrats, a number of some of the major office holders in the kingdom. They are members of the company. And so it's, and indeed it goes, and so it's not just Privy Council, but also as you mentioned, Parliament, where there are a number of members of Parliament who are members of the company. There are a number of merchants who on occasion will serve in Parliament. And then, of course, there are also a number of members of Parliament who really don't like the company. So you've got these kind of interesting and complicated ties between the company, which from company minutes, you'd think, you know, well, actually, you don't think as soon as you read them, but from the way that we talk about the company kind of in common parlance, makes it seem like the company is a separate thing. But in fact, when you look, the membership ties really braid the company's members and their interests to the regime and to Parliament and to Privy Council in all kinds of complicated ways. Where and in fact, this was actually one of the topics, or rather the elements that I actually had to spend a lot of time teasing out, is how do I as a historian deal with the fact that so many of these people were members of other companies? And does that, you know, if they're also members of the Muscovy and the Land Company, like what do I do with that? And kind of interestingly, what I found is that to a large extent, like the people who govern the companies seem to be really good at kind of changing hats, I guess you could say, where when they're acting as East India Company members, as governors of the East India Company, they were making decisions that were sometimes to the detriment of the other bodies that they were parts of. So there's this kind of interesting, this Venn diagram that makes it very complicated. And then at the same time, this kind of establishment of certain priorities at different times.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon mm-hmm. the governance of the company itself and some of the issues that they dealt with that you detail in your book. I mean, how did the company resolve a lot of these? What mechanisms do they create to resolve a lot of these issues? And what were those issues that developed over time?
Uh-huh. So I mentioned the patent as the thing that creates a company. Well, the other thing that the patent does is that it sets out how the company is supposed to function. So it sets out that the company is this political body that has a yearly election. It has a governor. It has 24 committees. And it sets out how power should shift in the middle of a year if the governor dies or something like that. So it sets out some provisions for how the company should govern itself. And then it also gives this provision to the company saying that it can govern itself beyond this as long as its rules are not in contravention of the laws of England. So it gives actually a lot of power to the company for self-government, and that's really important. So the company, between the patent, what's set out in the patent and what develops over time, the company has a governor, it has a deputy governor, it has a treasurer, and those are the three most important elected offices. And then it has 24 committees. And we think of a committee as like a body that already has a whole bunch of people on it. In the early 17th century, what a committee meant was an individual to whom something had been committed, like a responsibility or a trust or something like that. So a committee, so that body is called the Court of Committees. And these people, those 24 guys, because they're all men, those 24 men, the governor, the deputy governor, and the treasurer, those are the elected leaders of the company. Kind of collectively, we can refer to them as the Court of Committees. Now, those people are supposed to be elected every year. In fact, they are elected every year. There's an election in usually the first week of July of every year. And those were the people who, remember I said that they had all this kind of power really reposing in their hands. These are those people. So it's a pretty small group, 24 plus three, if you think of potentially 400 or 500 people in the company at large. So there's a lot of people who pay in their money, and they pay in a good bit of money. The minimum investment was £100, which was an enormous sum of money for most people. That you had to be pretty wealthy already to invest in the company. And some of those members in the company had investments of 20,000 as well. Like it's the minimum stakes is 100, and it can go up to very large amounts. So those people, most of the people who are members of the company don't actually get a say in the government of the company on a day-to-day basis. They elect people. And those people, those 24 plus governor, deputy, and treasurer, are the people who actually make the decisions on a day-to-day basis. Now, they met at least every few days, sometimes almost daily, to actually run this trade, because it turns out that there are things you have to do all year round to run the East Indies trade. So those people are meeting pretty frequently. They're making lots of decisions, and the wider membership, what's known as the generality, they actually only in the beginning only potentially get updated on affairs within the company twice a year. Later on, that's changed to four times a year, but it's much more infrequent than the kind of almost daily meetings sometimes of the Court of Committees. So they're picked by election, and those elections could sometimes be really contested because while the majority of elections ended up re-electing a large number of people, they at one point institute a rule saying that no more than essentially like 75% can be re-elected. But pretty much up to that point, almost everyone would be re-elected, or only a minimal amount would not be re-elected. So there sometimes are challenges to the authority of those leaders of the company for managing the trade, doing it in what the critics said was a very untransparent way. So remember, if you think if you are an investor who's, you know, paid your 100 pounds or your 500 pounds or however much, you've paid in a lot of money and you want to know what's going on, if you are only being informed maybe twice a year or four times a year, for some of those people that really graded, they wanted more insight, they wanted more access. And those terms of access, transparency, of secrecy, these are ones that turn up a lot in the company's minutes, because it turns out that there are these frequent contests between the leaders of the company, those elected leaders, and the generality over who gets to see what and when. So for the leaders of the company, they argued that secrecy was really important. And that's really normal in the early modern period. That's a completely standard pitch from anyone in power. If you're in power in the early modern period, you want it to be secret. You want people not to be able to question you. And that, so when they wanted to restrict access to the documents, to their meetings, to the letters that they get back from the East Indies, when they wanted all of that, that was really kind of in line with standard practice of the time. But the people who were paying in their money, who wanted more access, really, it kind of chafed them that they weren't able to get it. So what I found is that over the course of those first kind of 40 years of the company's existence, there are these frequent or at least intermittent instances of what the leaders of the company called faction, but are essentially these disagreements over who got access to what. And those could take place at election time, so in that kind of midsummer time, or they could take place not tied to election and were kind of posited as procedural changes that people wanted to make to ensure that members could get non-elected members could get more access to the decision making and the materials that the leaders had. Now, the election day meetings, when they were contested, and it's not often, it's only a few times, but when they were contested, it could get really heated, because what ended up happening is that in those meetings, people, the challengers were really kind of challenging the basis of political representation within the company. So one of the if I saw this in a description of an election meeting, I knew it was a contentious one, was whether or not someone would say, we need to use the ballot box. So today, the assumption tends to be that a secret ballot is a fairer way to cast a vote. That was not at all the case in the early 17th century. Secret ballots were actually seen by many people as kind of destabilizing means of voting, because if you could do it in secret, maybe, you know, who knows, like you could be led by your worst instincts because no one would know, rather than it would allow the freest choice. So when people would say, we want to use the ballot box, for the people in power, that was a sign that they wanted what the leader saw as kind of to increase factional disputation within the company. For the other people, and unfortunately, I only have the records of the people in power. I don't know what the way that the challengers would have put it is, because the records that have survived have been from people in power. So they tend to be pretty negative about the challengers. But the challengers wanted a ballot box, and they use those same arguments of it will allow a freer choice. It will mean that people aren't swayed by what other people want them to do. And so there are a lot of contests over, are we going to use a ballot box? Are we not going to use a ballot box? There's a great instance where someone brings a ballot box, and it's an amazing artifact. It still exists. It's really unusual. I mean, we don't have a lot of these at all. It's this kind of fascinating object, this actual ballot box. It's really decorated. It's huge. I've been privileged enough to see it. It's in the Sadler's Company collection, and they were very generous and let me inspect it. So someone actually brought it. A guy named John Holloway brought it in 1619, and it's almost a kind of humorous moment where he says, "I want to use a ballot box." The company said, "Well, we don't have a ballot box. We don't want one. But more importantly, we don't have one." And he kind of like pulls it out, like, "Well, look, I have here a ballot box," and it's a I mean, that artifact, it's really elaborate. Like, this is not something you put together in a spare time. Like, this is something that was commissioned, a significant amount of money and time went into the making of it. And that election, that particular election of 1619, was the most contentious one in the period that I was looking at. And ultimately, the king actually, the leaders of the company knew it was going to be a contentious problem. They'd been hearing about kind of unease and disquiet amongst the generality for some weeks at that point. They had their own ace up their sleeve, which was a message from the king saying, I don't want the leadership to change. But that kind of contest where you got the monarch kind of stepping in and saying, I want this, I want order, I don't want things to be thrown into confusion. And then on the other side, the challenger saying, ballot boxes, we want more access, we want more insight into what's going on, we want to be able to challenge their decisions. That's kind of the big contest.
You describe that some of these changes that they're trying to push through in these meetings and how that can be done internally, but a lot of changes that the members of the company sometimes desire require going back and changing the patent, and that involves part of this ongoing interplay between the company on the one hand and the king and the Privy Council on the other. I was wondering if you could explain some of the major changes they were trying to push through during this period and why it was that they were pursuing those changes.
Mm-hmm. So some of the changes, there's always reference to the patent. It's not actually always clear. So what's funny about it is that the patent is this written document. Like it's multiple written documents, in fact. So that you've got these physical documents. The physicality of these documents makes it seem like they're really clear, because you know you can consult this piece of paper, but it's actually not nearly as clear-cut as anyone involved would like it to be. So from the perspective of the monarch, what the patent grants is pretty clear. From the perspective of the company leaders, what the patent grants is pretty clear. But from the perspective, those two perspectives are still not the same thing. So both of them think that they're on pretty strong ground here, but at the same time, and they're both using reference to the same documents, but they've actually got very different understandings of what that means sometimes. So I'll come back to that in a second, but I also want to mention that like the challengers to the leadership of the company, they're also referencing the patent. So you've got people within the company saying, this is what the patent says, and other people saying, no, that's not what the patent says. So both of them kind of claiming that they've got kind of ultimate, you know, right or authority on their side based on these written documents. And the written documents are not nearly as clear cut as they would like them to be. Now, that kind of reference to these physical documents is really normal in the early 17th century. Cities keep city archives, government archives, like patents, like these actual physical documents are documents of immense authority and weight in and of themselves. Like they're really elaborate. If you ever see an early modern patent, it's very elaborately done. It's kind of an illuminated, usually like it could be black and white, but usually there's color on it. So it's kind of embossed and gilded, and the seal that's attached to it can be, they can be enormous. Like if you go to the archives now, when you pull out one of these, they're in special boxes so that they don't get damaged. They want you to use gloves and like all kinds of specialized equipment to make sure that you don't damage these things. But these are really elaborate documents. Physically, they're imposing. They look authoritative. And so everyone's kind of referencing these same physical documents, but with very, sometimes very different understandings of what they promise and what's involved. If you wanted a patent if they want to change their patent, the way that company leaders can do this is to go to the Privy Council and the King and ask for a new patent. We say patent and it sounds like it's singular. They talk about patents because every new grant that they get is a new patent that they kind of add to their collection of patents, to the kind of collective pool of what they're authorized to do. So they can amend or get new patents. They can also lose their patents. It's this patent, as I said, this is a relationship with the monarch. That means that it can also end. That relationship can end. And so patents can be called in. There's an actual specific legal mechanism for calling in a patent. It's called quo warranto, which means by whose warrant. So if the monarch wants to challenge the company's reading of the patent, and this would be like pulling out the big guns, like this is not happening on a, you know, this is when all else has failed, but they can call in the patent for legal examination. And then the company actually, again, has to surrender the physical patents, bring them in, and it has to be they have to decide whether or not the authorities have to decide whether or not you get them back. And usually if it's called in, it's usually to not be given back, to be taken away. That's how the Virginia Company got dissolved, for example, in 1624, which the East India Company was very aware of. So all these kind of contestations in the East India Company, corporate bodies are full of contests like this, other ones as well. And the Virginia Company, for example, was really, really riven by factional discord in the late teens and early 20s. And in the Virginia Company, it led to losing their patent. It became a royal colony. The East India Company, because so many of those merchants were part of the Virginia Company, and so many of the gentry as well, who were members of one, were members of the other. They're very aware. They were very aware of what was going on there. And so one of the things I saw was that within the East India Company, they worked really hard to manage discord, and they managed to be successful at it in a way that some of those same people weren't in another corporate setting in the Virginia Company. I suspect that because things were so tense in the Virginia Company, that was kind of an added impetus to keep things, if at all possible, under control in the East India Company. You don't want it falling apart everywhere.
One of the things that you describe when the approach about these patents is that it gives the crown a degree of leverage. And I was thinking that how, as I was reading those sections about it, how the James can come across at times as a bit of a bully. And I was thinking, for example, about how he may or may not have used it to leverage money to go to the Muscovy company so they could give it to the Tsar. But it also gets to this other dynamic, which is that comes across in your book, which is that this is not just about business, that the East India Company is and some of these other companies as well are representatives of England internationally, that they're playing this role that is not just a private role, but oftentimes they are playing a public role as well, and that the state has a very real interest having delegated this degree of sovereignty to ensuring that the company does things the way that the crown wants them to.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Like the East India Company, when it goes abroad, it is the English state abroad. There isn't another English ambassador. There isn't another English, you know, trading body, anything like that. So for the nations, for the empires that the East India Company interacts with in the East Indies, they are the English state, and that overlap is again by design, by like that if the patent represents that kind of wedding of the corporate, the merchants and the regime, the consequences of that are that they are absolutely representatives of the regime when they are abroad. And when it seems like James or the Privy Council is kind of hauling in the reins, I suppose, on the company at times, that is because the company is never acting solely as some kind of economic body when it's abroad. It is absolutely acting as a representative of the English state. The company members are completely aware of that. They see themselves as state actors. They talk about themselves as state actors. The title of the book, in fact, comes from a comment by a privy counselor who says that, you know, that he said that James was, of course, very interested in the company and caring of the company because and couldn't let it fail because it was a business of state. So that overlap between what the regime needs and what the company does abroad is implicit from the patent on. And so when the company acts abroad, it relies on the powers of the crown, it relies on the powers of the regime, and it is in many cases also then creating they're enacting the farthest reach of the English state abroad. The East India Company, for example, has an ambassador to the Mughal Empire appointed in 1614, an English ambassador. Now, that embassy is incredibly important to the East India Company. And the Mughal Empire at that time is one of the richest empires in the world. And that ambassador is completely royally accredited. It's a courtier. That person is not a merchant. But that embassy, so it's paid for by the East India Company, but it's accredited by the monarch. And it kind of shows this weird triangulation between who needs what done where, whether this is a private company, a public company. The book really explores at length the way that those categories don't work for this, because there's so many ways in which this is a private or slash public body that is doing private slash public things. And so that ambassador kind of really represents this way in which James on his own wouldn't have appointed an ambassador to the Mughal court. He had no diplomatic interests in 1614 that required an ambassador at the Mughal court. He had plenty that required Spain, that required France, that required, you know, The Hague. Like, there are all kinds of places where he needs an ambassador. The Mughal court, less so. If he needs an ambassador at the Mughal court, it's only because the company needs an ambassador at the Mughal court. And so you get this kind of case where the company is funding an ambassador. They don't fund, most ambassadors are funded by the crown, really badly, it turns out. That particular person, Sir Thomas Rowe, actually was paid. Many English ambassadors were not, or rather, they technically were paid, but they didn't actually get their money for a very long time. So there are distinct differences. But the monarch, like the ambassador, is fully accredited by the monarch, even as it's paid by a commercial body. And that kind of sums up in many ways this strange overlap between state interests and private interests. The other place where you really see that overlap, so it's not just in diplomatic provisions, but also in military actions, where when the East India Company acts abroad in any kind of military fashion, they're not just acting as a company, they're acting as representatives of the English state. And so this raises all kinds of questions in the period for, can the company make military decisions that are going to have consequences for England on their own? And that's also then complicated by the fact that company men and who are posted in the East Indies are posted essentially years away. It's a voyage that takes at minimum 6 months, and you can only make it at certain times of the year. So those are people who are in many cases acting on they have to act on their own initiative, on delegated authority. But there's this heightened concern that if they do something abroad, they could potentially inveigle the English state, not just the company, but the English state into what they do. And so one of the cases that I look at in the book is there are a few cases like this where these questions come up. One is what happens when the company acts in a way militarily and what the in a way that is militarily and, sorry, military and not necessarily at the instigation of the regime, in when they, for example, ally with Persian forces to expel the Portuguese from Hormuz. And that particular case leads to a long drawn out conflict between the company and particularly James and Buckingham, the Duke of Buckingham, who at the time was Lord Admiral of England and in charge of any kind of military action abroad, at whether or not they acted in that capacity as representatives of the English state. And if they did, then that meant that Buckingham claimed that he should be getting 10% of everything that they took as plunder, which was estimated at some 100,000 pounds. So it would have been a 10,000 pound kind of bounty for him. James also claimed 10,000 pounds, although his grounds were much sketchier in terms of legal justification. If they weren't acting on behalf of the English state, then were they just acting piratically? And that's also not okay. So there is this kind of question in that case. The other case that I looked at really on those lines was about the Riches, the Earl of Warwick, flying under authority of the Duke of Savoy. So he wasn't actually even flying as a sailing under James's flag, but sailing under the authority of the Duke of Savoy, sent a pirate ship fleet, I guess, to the East Indies, and took ships that belonged to the Mughal the Mughal emperor's mother, the queen mother, and she owned a number of ships and used them to transport pilgrims to and from Mecca, or rather to and from the Arabian Peninsula. And they in that case, East India Company men and ships stepped in and took back those ships and returned them. And that led to a long conflict with the Earl of Warwick over whether or not they were allowed to do that. And their argument was that we're the only people, English people, who are legitimately active in this area. When you act like this, even though you're not doing East India Company's stuff, you are still, as the company became the representatives of the English state, similarly, Warwick's men would be representatives of the English state. And since the English state abroad meant the East India Company, they'd be lumped all together and they could jeopardize the East India Company's trade. So these kind of really complex questions turn up over and over again in the early 17th century because they don't really have there's no tradition really to draw on, because all of this is happening in a bigger way and farther away than most English actions up to that point have been. So they're really kind of working out all these legal categories and relationships for themselves at that time.
One final layer of complexity that you describe is how a lot of those dynamics and relationships change with the monarch himself. You spend most of the book talking about the operations of the company during the reign of James I. But after he dies in 1625 and his son takes over, you have a monarch who has very different views, very different priorities, and who in effect changes the relationship between the company and the state as a result.
Yeah, the company is, again, it goes back to the patent. And if it seems like I'm kind of harping on the patent, it's because it's just so intrinsic to understanding the company in this period. Because that patent is about a monarch and a company, a corporate body, when the monarch changes, what the patent means changes. Because, again, a patent is not self-evident. Even though it seems self-evident, it's not self-evident. So it requires interpretation. And the company's interpretation changes over time. The monarch's interpretation changes over time and certainly changes from monarch to monarch. So Elizabeth's understanding, James's understanding, and then Charles's understanding are all very different. Now, Elizabeth was only queen for a few years, as in she was queen for a very long time, but she was only queen for the first few years of the company's existence. And then James was very willing to kind of test the company. He was certainly willing to push boundaries and to really demand quite a lot of the company. You mentioned the loan to the Muscovy, to the czars in Muscovy, that particular loan was given. It was kind of required for James's assistance on pulling back from a potential Scottish East India Company, and that. Which raises, again, all kinds of interesting questions over who does the company really represent? Is it just an English East India Company or is it a British East India Company? In this period, it pretty clearly is an English East India Company, but they are able to get the Scottish patent pulled and that they are, even though they're really English, they're the only ones. James is really willing to push them, but at the same time, they're able to push back. So there is this kind of give and take between a monarch and company, which is really, ultimately the heart of any negotiation, right? Like neither side wins all the time. Where in that case, they give a loan they probably wouldn't have given otherwise, and they underwrite the Muscovy Company in a way they probably wouldn't have by choice, but at the same time, they are given a lot in return, and including the choice of ambassador, or at least the approval of ambassador who is sent to accompany that money, and he's given quite a lot of authority to actually give or actually not give that loan in situ. So it's a complicated back and forth between them, but it's pretty strained at the time of James's death because of that Hormuz, that account for Hormuz, where he essentially coerces £20,000, £10,000 for him and £10,000 for the Duke of Buckingham out of the company. Then Charles becomes the monarch, and then everything's up for grabs again. It's not clear. Once James was dead, it became very easy for company members to kind of talk about what he would have wanted and what he didn't want. You know, it's very easy to speak for the dead in that way. And in many cases, Charles was having none of it. And Charles's relationship to the count, to the company was very different, where you saw that sometimes very tense back and forth between James and the company. With Charles, that back and forth actually didn't work nearly as well. I mean, one of the things about a back and forth, if that's going to work, is that both sides actually have to be able to communicate pretty easily with the other. And so while under James's reign, what I saw was that company and privy councilors met a lot. Company members, that court of committees, the governor, the deputy, they met pretty frequently with the privy council. They were called before the privy council. They came to the privy council on a not a regular basis in the sense that every Monday or anything like that, but they were there a lot. They mentioned it. They talk about it. There was this kind of easy recourse that changed under Charles and that changed pretty quickly under Charles by the late 1620s. So just a few years into Charles's reign, that sense of that easy recourse was gone from the minutes. And there's this one great, not great for the company, but great for me as a historian, account where, the company merchants, the leaders, they go to meet with Charles, and they've got this petition that they want to hand him, and they just wait outside of the Privy Council doors. They talk about waiting and watching people go back and forth, and then finally kind of buttonholing the William Laud, bishop, and kind of maybe an archbishop at that point, but buttonholing him and kind of compelling him to say, like, okay, when can we actually meet with Charles? And him kind of like, well, try again tomorrow morning. We'll see if that'll work out. And so that sense of that easy, you know, again, they didn't always get their way, but that sense of communication, that open communication was there. And that really changes under Charles. And indeed, Charles actually took a lot made a lot of decisions and took a lot of actions that kind of showed that he didn't value the company in quite the same way. And in fact, was not very pleased always with what they did and how they were constituted.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I'm working on this book, you know, as with any book, right, it takes up a lot of your time for a very long time. And then you have to transition into a new project. This book really explored the East India Company from its formation to the late 1630s. But it was really focused very much on what was happening in England. There are lots of ways in which what was happening in the East Indies kind of really impacted that. But what I was really trying to tease out is that relationship between the company and the state. I think for my next project, I'm going to move to the East Indies a little bit and look a little bit more at the company, the men who were posted abroad in these what are called factories of the East Indies. So factories doesn't mean someplace where stuff got made, but someplace where factors or employees lived. So looking at these factories, which are these kind of small communities in major trading outposts, or rather they're trading outposts in major trading cities across the East Indies, and how do they learn to live abroad? How do they learn to deal with regimes and political systems that are very different from what they were used to? And in many cases, where they had to live for if they don't die, that was always a risk. But if they survived, that they places where they would be for a number of years, usually 3 or 4, sometimes longer. But where they were sent alone, they were not supposed to be married, or if they were, they were not supposed to bring their wives. So something about these factors. I'm still in the very early stages, but I've been collecting materials. I'm kind of looking forward to digging in.
Well, it sounds like an amazing project. I look forward to reading it when it's done.
I hope it'll be good.
Rupali Mishra, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.